We've made everything very pragmatic and practical, and you're almost considered odd if you find something other than that.
Right. Pastor, I'm not much of a theologian, but if you'll just give me the six principles in the paragraph, can you abstract for me what I can apply in my business next week?
Yes.
Actually, no, because this is about a God who redeems by the blood of his son, and you probably don't want to do much of that in your business.
Right, exactly. This isn't about you.
Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn, where we're continuing our series through the Gospel according to Joshua. What a wonderful book this is, this small-scale story of Israel's larger plot, which in itself is a story within a story of the world at large that lies in Adam, incapable of solving its own problem, and therefore looking forward to the one who will. We're having a great time walking through this story of God's conquest and deliverance of the land to his people, fulfilling his promise that he made to Abraham in Genesis 15, with your usual hosts, Kim Riddlebarger, pastor of Christ Reformed Church in Anaheim, California. Rod Rosenblatt teaches theology at Concordia University in Irvine. Ken Jones, pastor of Glendale Baptist Church in Miami, Florida. And I'm Mike Horton. I teach at Westminster Seminary, California. Gentlemen, we have gone through the various sections of this book, kind of divided according to the themes of another Exodus, then conquest, as they cross the Jordan. This is like another crossing of the Red Sea. And now we're taking a look at the division of the land.
By the way, Mike, to add to the parallels between this and the Exodus, you have Joshua before the crossing of the Jordan. You have him being summoned by, we mentioned the captain of the Lord's host. And the last thing the captain tells him is, take off your shoes. This is holy ground.
Interesting.
Yes.
Great point.
Just like at the burning bush.
Exactly. Yeah.
Whoever this is,
yeah,
the same one who was speaking out of the burning bush, yeah, and he's the commander of the army of the Lord.
Yeah.
Who many centuries later would come down not as a theophany, but as the
flesh,
incarnate Son of God. Now we're talking about God's gift of the land as an inheritance. And one of the points that we've made all along is that God gives the land, grants it to him. It's a land grant. Gives it to him as a free gift on the basis of the promise that he made to Abraham. And yet on the way to that land, there was another covenant that the people swore at Mount Sinai, all this we will do. And that covenant was to regulate the terms of their remaining in the land once they got there.
And that covenant is the book of Deuteronomy.
That's the constitution that Israel would live or die under. And so let's remind folks again how important it is to distinguish that Abrahamic promise, even just concerning the land, which is pure gift, and the Mosaic covenant, which establishes the terms of remaining in the land.
Huge. If you don't get that right, you're going to read Joshua as timeless principles of leadership. So you're going to hear sermon series after sermon series on how to be a great leader, emulate the life of Joshua.
Or it'll become a 4th of July sermon. And
right.
Or how to conquer not only lands, but I've seen portions of Joshua, especially marching around the walls of Jericho, but anything that a Christian desires. If you want to possess this, then this is what you must do, as Joshua did.
Just march around it seven times?
That actually happened.
Oh,
I'm not going to.
I've been to the Porsche dealer, and it just doesn't work.
I'm not going to say which church it happened in, but it happened in a church of the Reformation that they danced around the altar seven times. It was shocking to hear that it happened in this denomination. But it really is becoming a broader movement. It's not just Pentecostalism as a movement or tradition. It's becoming very influential even in mainstream churches, isn't it? Non-Pentecostal churches,
heavens,
I should say.
Yeah.
So now God has done everything. One of the things that has been stressed over and over again in the book of Joshua is, and the Lord gave it, and the Lord fought for Israel. I will give them into your hand. Israel isn't winning this war. God is winning the war and handing over the cities for destruction and giving them the land that the idolaters were sitting on.
Right. That's the proof that it's divine gift, because Israel could never, ever capture this land on their own.
Yeah, and
it
every
has
time
to be given them by God.
Every time they thought they could flex their muscles, they were reminded that they can't. They don't have muscles to flex.
So chapters 13 through roughly 22, verse 9, focus on the division of the land and giving the nation as an inheritance. Joshua 13:8 marks this transition from the phase of conquest to dividing the spoils. It's not a haphazard land rush, like the Oklahoma land rush that my grandma was a baby in. Each man for himself, you know, just go stake your claim. It certainly wasn't looting and pillaging, as the wicked there had regularly done with each other. It's an orderly distribution of the inheritance God had prescribed for each tribe. And Numbers chapters 32 to 35 just tell us how orderly that was. I have to say, I heard a wonderful sermon just last Sunday from Pastor Zach Keel on the orderliness of this itself being significant, with the promises of blessing and less blessing given to Jacob's sons being fulfilled now in this inheritance, and Judah at the lead. Of course, Christ would come from the tribe of Judah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And so there's an arrow pointing out, but then the priesthood and the tabernacle in the center. Everything is turning inward. To go to God, you actually go inward towards the center of the camp, looking at bloody priests.
Uh-huh. Good for that pastor.
And then you go outward, forward toward history with Judah leading.
Hey, wow, that's a great point.
And so everything is pointing forward to Christ, not only as the priest who enters the sanctuary with his own blood at the center of Israel, but also the Lion of the tribe of Judah leading Israel to the promised land.
The kingly office,
God's not just orderly because, you know, he's kind of type A. He's orderly because the order matters. It's all pointing forward to what he's going to do in history. Now, just as God subdued the watery chaos and set creature kings over each realm in Genesis 1 and 2, is he turning chaos here into an ordered cosmos by placing his land under the rule of these 12 tribes? In other words, are these 12 tribes now sort of, because we've seen a lot of echoes of creation here, is it reading too much into it to say these 12 tribes are like the creature kings in Genesis 1 and 2 ruling over the creature kingdoms?
Yeah.
And now God is saying, look, you're my viceroys to bring order out of chaos and rule over these realms.
Exercising dominion.
Sure. You don't want to press it too far, but I mean, you go back to the creation account and you have Genesis 1:26 giving Adam dominion over all these things. And then you see this kind of replicated here in the dividing of the land, especially with the godless Canaanites who worshiped the sun, the moon, and the stars, that the creation account is basically saying, no, you worship the one who made the sun, moon, stars. So it is a connection in terms of the creation account being the attack on paganism. Right? We're looking in the creation account for explanations as to how God created, and you know, that's another story for another time. But one of the things that is true of the creation account is it is a shot across the Canaanite bow.
Yeah,
I think it's also interesting for those who really understand and know the world of religions. And the category is just fertility slash power.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
But here you have a contrast to that. It isn't just fertility slash power. That orderliness isn't common in the study of the breadth of human religion. It just isn't.
It's a great point, Rod. Ancient Near Eastern scholars have pointed out the radical difference between how the pagans looked at chaos and order versus how Israel did. For the pagans, it was cosmic. It turned on the seasons and managing the gods, placating the gods so that the harvest would go well and so forth. For Israel, it's all ethical. It's a moral relationship with a covenant Lord who happens to also be your God, your king.
Right, right.
Your head of state happens to also be the God you worship.
Yeah, and some of the pagan religions, Babylonian religions in particular, the chaos is explained by the conflict between the gods. It's it's these two, it's Marduk and who's the other god?
Tiamat,
of fighting one another.
Right.
And this is, so you begin with the conflict.
Good God, bad God.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, God does the work. Joshua is simply to receive the Lord's victory and parcel out the geographical spoils according to his word. You think of Ephesians 4, where Jesus ascended. And in his ascent, he poured out his spirit to distribute gifts to his people.
Yeah.
I mean, the spoils of his victory. All Israel has to do at this point in the story is just receive the inheritance. God is saying, here is your piece of land. Here's your piece of land. This is for this tribe. This is for that tribe. Well, by the way, I've done it all, and now I'm gifting it to you.
And why that is so important on a practical level for Israel is Joshua's turned into an old geezer by now. And in chapter 13, you were given hints, you know, he's old, he's advanced in years. So it's very important for Israel to grasp that principle that God is king, because the replacement to Moses is about to go to glory.
Yeah. Batons will pass from pastor to pastor, but God is always the one. Don't forget, Joshua didn't do this either.
Exactly.
And they forget, and that's why we have a book of Judges.
The first time we really see a statement of Israel's halting from fully carrying out what God had said in verse 13, yet the people of Israel did not drive out the Geshurites or the Maacathites, but Geshur and Maacath dwell in the midst of Israel to this day.
And those Geshurites, man, we know all about them.
Yeah. The same failure is mentioned in chapter 15, verse 63. So eventually, such allowance, such entertainment of the serpent in the garden, as Adam allowed, would lead to Israel's seduction, just as God had warned in his command for total destruction in Deuteronomy 7, verse 4, Deuteronomy 12, 29 through 31. In those verses, he says, I mean, you know what happened with Adam and Eve. You tolerate the serpent to live, and eventually your grandchildren are going to be pagans.
And the Israelites become so oppressed in Judges, they have to hide in caves for part of the time.
Yep. Right. A notable exception in this account is Caleb. In verses 6 through 15 of chapter 14, Joshua accedes to Caleb's request to conquer Hebron in spite of the fearsome strength of the Anakim living there and the fact that Caleb is now 85 years old.
Wow.
So again, God is just stacking up the odds. It's sort of like telling Elijah to pour water
on the sacrificial altar.
Yeah,
make it impossible for fire to touch it.
Yeah,
and burn it
just to show that God is God is God. Confident in Yahweh, Caleb was given strength equal to his youth at 85 years old, and he inherited Hebron as a type of those who don't shrink back, but inherit God's blessing through faith. And that's how Hebrews 10:39 interprets Caleb's faith. Not shrinking back, but trusting in God and inheriting God's blessing through faith. So, after Israel's victories now, we read in chapter 14, verse 15, the land had rest from war. What's significant about that phrase that we see again in chapter 11, verse 23? The land had rest from war.
This is one of the great covenant blessings, peace. And it foreshadows the eternal rest, not only the weekly Sabbath, which foreshadows the heavenly rest, where there will be no more wars, no rumors of wars. The great image, for example, in the book of Revelation of there being no more sea. You know, there won't even be an abode for the dragon to live in, because the dragon, of course, is a sea monster, and at least in the typology. So
now people are thinking, oh, I kind of like the ocean. There won't be any oceans in heaven?
It's not that God hates the ocean.
No,
not that at all.
It's about the fear that ancient people had that you couldn't tame the sea.
It was a place where
darkness
and storms
foreboding
came from there.
Yeah.
So in this case, one of the great blessings, the typological blessing of the eternal rest is the land is at peace.
Mm-hmm. And it's two dimensions to that peace, the enmity with God, which has been satisfied by the promise typified in the sacrifices fulfilled in the coming Messiah, the greater Joshua, but then peace on a horizontal level.
Right.
And that is, again, it's the fulfillment. It's the bringing of both of those together. There won't be one without the other.
And a long period here of fighting. The generations are now, you know, multiple that have seen combat.
And what you'll see later is as they are settled in the land, it's the reverse. Because of their violations of the law with God, or they're disrupting the peace that they have with God, they will not have peace with their neighbors.
Right.
And don't you also see, again, an echo here of Adam and Eve in the garden before the fall, after God had subdued chaos, which is not another God, it's not even evil. It's just, you know, like
disorder,
calming the storm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. God brings order out of chaos. The land had rest from chaos.
Mm-hmm.
The Sabbath rest is held out, but for now the land has rest from war. And then Adam, unfortunately, allows the serpent to beguile his wife, just as Israel is about to do.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And all of that peace is disrupted. So now you still have relationships within the earth, but there's going to be conflict.
Chapter 15 continues the measuring out of the allotted inheritance. The division of the inheritance concludes in chapter 18 with the report, "Then the whole congregation of the people of Israel assembled at Shiloh and set up the tent of meeting there. The land lay subdued before them."
Yeah, that's just amazing.
What's significant about the way that is stated, the verb?
The land was subdued by Yahweh.
Lays subdued.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not there for them to subdue.
Right,
yeah.
It's just laying there subdued.
Yes. He has fulfilled his promise to his people.
Again, just as God, by his word, subdued chaos and divided creation into allotted and ordered realms under various creature kings in Genesis, with man as his viceroy over all, Canaan's moral chaos, darkness and void, has been overcome.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's a covenant.
By God for the people's benefit.
That's right.
Right. Yep.
That's amazing. Now a covenant can be made because now the situation that didn't allow for, there was no place for God to dwell with his people until he cleared off the idolaters from his land. Now a covenant can be made. Now God can enter into a covenantal relationship, again, just as he did in creation after making an ordered place. So now the serpent has been partially driven out. Some of the serpents and scorpions have been crushed. But each tribe, like a creature king, has its realm to guard and keep on Israel's behalf. It's like you have 12 Adams now.
Uh-huh.
And each one is supposed to stand guard as a priest and king over that gate of the holy temple.
Five of them already are, seven to go.
And the Levites, of course, are given their own plot where they don't work for a living.
Right.
They are provided for so that they can be full-time intercessors on behalf of sinful people. So once again, measuring the distance between Israel's story and the dreary record of empires and nations invoking religious justification for violence, the real hero here is not Israel. It's Yahweh.
Right.
Again, who writes this story? Don't nationalistic religions usually make their God a mascot for their victory?
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Contrast.
Just the opposite here. Joshua isn't George Washington. He's not represented as a founding father.
That's huge to me because I've heard very otherwise good Bible teachers find in Joshua all of these great leadership principles. And Joshua, at his best in the book of Joshua, is simply trusting God.
Yeah.
And that's why he is a great leader. And
yes.
there is some of that there, but that misses the whole point of the story.
Yeah.
Pull that out as though that were the story.
Because the whole point is not his leadership, but his faith in Yahweh.
Yep. Exactly.
Right.
Because Yahweh, he knew what Yahweh promised he could pull off.
You know, could it be that this is the sort of heretical thing to which Americans are particularly prone because we're so deeply pragmatic? We will miss the story of God's redeeming love for the earth, and we'll replace it with that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And we fall for it every time.
I think you're right, Rod. I think that came up when we discussed Rahab and the interest in the ethicists trying to figure out, now, how exactly do we get her off the hook here? Missing the whole point that God redeems this sinful woman.
Right. As he does all of the other sinful people.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's like, let's talk about, okay, we could talk about that as a sort of sidebar.
Yes.
But you're missing the main story here.
And I do think you're right that is the particular contribution that we Westerners have made to the history of heresy. And that is we've made everything very pragmatic and practical, and you're almost considered to be odd.
Yeah,
you find something other than that.
Right. Or, Pastor, I'm not much of a theologian, but if you'll just give me the six principles in the paragraph.
Mm-hmm. Or the seven.
Can you abstract for me what I can apply in my business next week?
Yes.
Actually, no. Because this is about a God who redeems by the blood of his Son. And you probably don't want to do much of that in your business.
Right.
That's the story.
Right, exactly. This isn't about you.
Yeah.
It's for you, but it's not about you.
Yeah.
And that's good news for you.
That is very good news.
Thus, verse 43 of chapter 21, once again we read, "Thus the Lord gave to Israel all the land that he swore to give to their fathers," harking back to that promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. "And they took possession of it, and they settled there." So now that's marking a transition. God gave it. And doesn't this really underscore the point that God has fulfilled his promise to Abraham? When people say, go back to Genesis 15 and say, now this is forever and unconditional and inviolable. Because it's unilateral, it's one way.
I.e. dispensationalists.
Right. And it's still the case that Israel, the modern nation state of Israel, is God's chosen nation. They're going to rebuild the temple.
They're back in the land.
So on and so forth. That when that happens, people fail to realize that God fulfilled the promise this day that we're talking about in history. Yep.
And as Kim has pointed out, in very specific ways. This is not just a general principle.
Yeah.
God promised particular lands that whose boundaries have been set, and those are the boundaries that were occupied by the people that inherited that particular promise.
Exactly.
But he promised to give them the land that those tribes were on.
Exactly.
He didn't promise that in spite of their violation of the covenant they swore at Mount Sinai, they would live on that land no matter what.
Right.
No.
That's the key.
So 43, again, the Lord gave to Israel all the land he swore to give to their fathers, and they took possession of it and settled there. That's a slam dunk as far as Israel inheriting the land. That fulfills that portion of the Abrahamic covenant. Done.
Check that box.
So that in the new covenant, the land promise is universalized to the ends of the earth.
So the unconditional promise has been fulfilled. The other unconditional promise that is left unfulfilled as of yet is that a seed of Abraham is coming in whom all the families of the earth will be blessed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, and in the prophetic passages, particularly Isaiah, Jeremiah, that speak of the regathering of the tribes, at that point now it goes back to the promised land as being a type of the earth that would be inherited by the people of God. And if we don't see that, that's how I think we end up with people trying to reestablish these particular boundaries and look at the prophetic passages concerning the fulfillment, the second advent of the Messiah, that when he comes and he gathers his people from the north, the south, and the east, they want to fit that into this particular promise. But it's a different thing. That's something different.
It's a great event in history when in 1948, Jews, ethnic descendants of Abraham, are living again in the area that was once holy.
Yes.
But it's so important to see that they're not now living in a holy land.
Right.
One of our professors used to make a big point whenever the student would mention the Holy Land. No, it was the Holy Land.
Right.
And that's always stuck with me. We have to be real careful to speak of it as formerly the Holy Land, now the nation of Israel.
Yeah, because since the incarnation, he's made the whole earth holy, and he will consummate it in his second advent.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it's no small thing to have a hermeneutic like that. That's not a slight misunderstanding, but a gross one. It sets you off on all sorts of false trails when you've got that hermeneutic.
Right.
And when the whole point is to point forward, the whole point of this regime, the whole point of the nation of Israel was to point forward to the one who would be the Holy Land.
Right.
He is the temple.
Yes. Right.
And
right.
whatever is annexed to his territory becomes holy.
Yeah. Yes. I have people ask me all the time, well, do you think dispensationalism is heretical? Well, no.
No.
But what happens if you hold to a dispensational hermeneutic is you make some connections in the Old Testament, a disconnect from their New Testament fulfillment, so that you lose the plain sense of a whole block of Scripture.
And you'll God bless you for answering that way. I think that's the most accurate way it can
you'll
be evaluated.
You'll end up looking for things in the Old Testament that are fulfilled in Christ. You'll end up, for example, I heard just the other day a very noted dispensational Bible teacher speak of how the agricultural produce in Israel, which you know is shipped off to Europe, and you can go to London and find Israeli fruit in the grocery store, that that's the fulfillment of the fact that Israel would flower again.
Ugh.
You know, well, not biblically.
No, it's not even, and an Orthodox Jew would say, that's not what the prophecies mean. It's not that supermarkets in London are going to have fruit from Hebron.
Right.
It's that everyone is going to be eating and drinking with God in lush vineyards. I mean, there's no way to describe this messianic kingdom in any greater terms than a lush vineyard with eating and drinking, the best meat, the well-aged wine.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best way you can explain the glories of Christ's kingdom.
Same thing with lions lying down with lambs.
Warring nations will be at peace with.
Exactly. These are all typological images of something that the people of God cannot yet understand until the tomb's empty.
Kim, you mentioned that not understanding Old Testament passages causes them to not see the fulfillment in the New Testament, but I think you have to even nuance that. It's a failure to understand these historical passages, as we're looking at here in Joshua, and see how those things have been fulfilled historically, which then leads you forward to the prophets. I think the problem begins with a separation of historical and the prophetic books.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know about you, Mike. The absence that I got on my dispensational Bible teaching, I never knew that passage in Joshua chapter 21, 43 even existed. We never talked about that. That verse just wasn't mentioned. Joshua 21:43, that the Lord gave Israel the land.
Mm-hmm.
That verse came as a real surprise to me later on when I started to look back at dispensationalism. The other thing, for example, is we never covered the Ten Commandments because they were for a different dispensation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's a sense in which
something went wrong.
You know, your hermeneutic so tweaks the way you read Scripture that you end up misreading huge chunks of the Old Testament.
Well, that's what I was trying to say earlier, only you've said it more accurately.
And a really respectable Bible teacher scholar has said pointedly on several occasions, the problem with covenant theology, which is basically what we're talking about here, is that it reads the Old Testament in the light of the New Testament.
That's the problem?
That's the problem. He says you have to read the Old Testament the way
a Jew of the time would have read it.
Exactly. And the obvious problem with that is all of the preaching and teaching and counsel about how you preach and teach and examples of interpreting the Old Testament by Jesus and the apostles.
Right. Right.
Is interpreting the Old Testament only in the light of New Testament fulfillment.
Sure. Right.
And it reminds me of Luther one time speaking of somebody who complains that there's no light, but he's put the blindfold over his own eyes and then complained that there's no light. I had a liberal Old Testament prof when my liberal group was turning left. I happened to be right when they were turning the corner to go toward liberal Europe. And in our opening Old Testament lecture, that gentleman said, our goal here is just what you said, Mike. we are not going to bring in the New Testament. We are going to read it as it stands, as if we were Jews. And I just about despaired, because it's like saying, we're going to go muddling around trying to figure out, without appeal to the New Testament, what this book means.
When the New Testament tells us. And the New Testament has normative status,
yes,
as the interpreter of the Old Testament.
Right. It isn't just, this was Paul's opinion on that particular Old Testament.
You know, we're Christians, and we claim the Old Testament as ours. Yeah. And therefore, we read it through the lens of Christ.
Right.
Kim, you said dispensationalism isn't a heresy. I think we all agree with that. But what do we say to a brother or sister who says that Old Testament saints were saved by works? Now, I know most mainstream dispensationalists don't say that anymore. But or that the New Testament church is God's plan B when Israel rejected God's plan of salvation.
Or that when push comes to shove, there are two ways of salvation, depending upon whether you're a Jew or a Gentile.
Yeah, now that was hyper-dispensationalism when I was growing up, not mainstream.
Okay.
I think one of the easiest solutions to that is to look through the New Testament, all the passages that speak of Gentile believers as children of Abraham. Mm-hmm. I mean, that really gets to the root of it. And as a dispensationalist kind of coming out of that, that was really helpful to me to just see how the New Testament treated Gentile Christians and Jewish Christians, both being children of Abraham, heirs to the promise, and the gift of the Holy Spirit. That's the way Paul presents it.
Right. Ephesians is
simply,
wonderful in doing that.
Ephesians chapter 2 is the death knell of the dispensationalism.
Well, and what's great, too, is remember the Apostle Paul says, not that there wasn't a church in the Old Testament, but the mystery of the church in the New Covenant is that Jew and Gentile are now
one.
Brought together in Christ as one people. And then he says, this was a mystery that wasn't known in the Old Testament.
Right.
So how could you possibly base your view of anything on the Old Testament without the New?
Well, one of the reasons I think our dispensational friends have to argue, Mike, as you pointed out, that we have to read the Old Testament as a Jew would, is because of language like Ephesians 2, beginning at verse 11, where Paul says the whole purpose of the coming Christ is to take the two people, one, to undo what we see in the court of the Gentiles in the Jerusalem temple, where Gentiles can only go to part but can't enter into the inner court. Well, Christ came to tear down that barrier that kept those two apart. So the purpose of redemptive history is not to have Gentiles as plan B, but to make Jew and Gentile both part of plan A.
Right.
And so it's not the church replacing Israel. It's the people of God being closely connected to Israel, but as we've seen in Joshua, they're the Gibeonites. There are others who are Gentiles who are part of the people of God and heirs to the covenant. Rahab, the people who repent during the preaching of Jonah, are Gentiles. Mm-hmm. They're a part of the covenant. So we don't have the church replacing Israel. We have God adding a gazillion Gentiles to the people of God.
Yeah, the prophets look forward to the day when a Gentile will grab onto the robe of a Jew and say, take us with you to Mount Zion to worship.
Yeah. Right. So this isn't replacement theology. This is expansion theology.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I kind of chafe when dispensationalists accuse us of holding replacement theology, because I don't know about you, but I don't know of any significant Reformed writer in eschatology who even remotely speaks that way.
No, we're grafted onto, we're wild vines grafted onto the native tree of Israel.
Yeah. Right.
And that's actually given to us in the prophets, in the coming of the Messiah, that those people that were the enemies of God, and he specifies Egypt, people from Egypt and Assyria, Babylon, they will come together with Israel and be the people of God. And God will say, these are my people.
On the mountain of the Lord, which is the heavenly Zion. Yep.
Okay, so now, the hero is Yahweh, and we read in verses 44 and 45 of chapter 21, and the Lord gave them rest on every side, for the Lord had given all their enemies into their hands, and here we go, not one word of all the good promises that the Lord had made to the house of Israel had failed. All came to pass.
That amazing.
That's pretty clear.
Doesn't that once again pretty much lock down the view that it's being announced right here on this day? There is nothing left of all of the promises concerning the land that God made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that is not fulfilled on this day. There's nothing left.
Dateable in human history.
And there you have, again, promise, fulfillment. Now you're going to have curse because of their failure to do what they what was required of them to remain in the land. Therefore, when you go to those same sorts of promises in the prophets, it's pointing to something greater, not this land.
Mm-hmm. Not going back, but going forward.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's just it. Nice. The arrow points toward Christ and then toward the eschaton, not back towards Israel. You don't go back to the types and shadows in the New Testament.
Right. No. Chapter 22 then reports the return of the eastern tribes after Joshua commends the 2.5 tribes for following God's commands. But Yahweh is the one, we read in verse 4, Yahweh is the one who has given rest to your brothers. So now they too are to take possession of their allotted inheritance. Only, he says, Joshua says, be very careful now to observe the commandment and the law. Loving God with your whole heart and soul. So this is now we're turning from pure gift to the terms of the Sinai covenant for remaining.
Not the Abrahamic.
Right. Not the Abrahamic. And now you see the treaty structure emerge. It's been often pointed out that the Bible follows really remarkably ancient Near Eastern, especially Hittite, political treaties between suzerains, that is, great kings, and vassals, where a great king will sweep in and save helpless people from a marauding army, and then annex them to his empire and give them the terms under which they will now live as his people.
And those terms are things like, when my armies march this way, I get to use your well.
Mm-hmm.
When I ring the emergency alarm and a call for warfare, you're going to contribute 3 men from your clan, you know, to the army, that kind of stuff.
Right.
Very specific stuff.
You're going to bring a tithe, to a tax.
A tribute. Yeah.
A tribute once a year in order simply to show, you know, for the revenues, but also to show that you recognize me, you acknowledge me as your king.
One interesting thing that Dr. Klein used to point out was the two tables of the law. You know, we think of
this is Meredith Klein.
Meredith Klein. We used to think of the two tables. Theologically, we divide the tables into duties toward God, duties toward neighbor. But historically, the giving of the two tablets fits the suzerainty treaty pattern because, in an age before stenographers, each of the party would be given a copy of the treaty.
They didn't have Xerox machines.
So outside your land, the king would prepare two copies. He'd keep one in the royal treasury. The other would be given to the suzerain. And the suzerain would display that treaty at some prominent point on the land on a stone tablet or an obelisk or a monument or something to let anybody knowing that he has a treaty with the great king, which is interesting why Moses had given two tables, two tablets.
Yeah, one for the archive and one
Right.
Let's go through those four elements. Typical treaty structure of a Hittite treaty was you had a preamble that identified the suzerain or great king who is making the treaty. It's not negotiated between the parties. The great king, it's not we the people, it's I, Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And then you have the historical prologue that justifies his sovereignty over that people so that he can impose the terms of the treaty. Then you have the terms, third, the stipulations, do this, don't do that. Then you have, fourth, the sanctions. Here's what happens if you obey. Here's what happens if you don't obey. And then, as you say, Kim, the last thing that would happen is, first of all, the deal would be ratified by a public ceremony, often the great king causing the lesser king to walk between pieces of animals cut in half to basically say in a public ceremony before all of his nobles, may the same thing happen to me if I fail to keep the terms of this treaty. And then
they barbecue the animals and eat them.
Yeah.
It's a great party.
And then the treaty itself is deposited in an archive. So that's why you call it the Ark of the Covenant. It's an archive. Like you go to Washington, D.C. to the National Archives and you see the U.S. Constitution. So you have this treaty structure followed in the story. Yahweh has delivered, historical prologue. Therefore, these are the stipulations for remaining in his land. The inheritance that Yahweh has won now rests in precarious hands, and the message is very clear. The land is holy now, been cleansed by holy war. It's holy now. You better keep it that way, because if you're unholy, the same thing curses is going to happen to you.
Wow. Again, going back to Genesis with Adam, Adam inherited a clean earth, and it was pure. And now it was his responsibility to keep it. Failure to do so brought about consequences.
Now, chapter 22, verses 10 through 34, you have the altar of witness dispute. The eastern tribes wanted to celebrate Yahweh's victory at the boundary of the Jordan, and the western tribes are ready to declare holy war on their brothers for erecting what they thought was a rival altar to the one God commanded at Shiloh. So basically, the eastern tribes are building this memorial, a tribute, just another tribute at the edge of the water to once again witness to what God had done. But Phinehas is saying, oh my goodness, our brothers in the eastern tribes are, what on earth are they building out there? Are they building a Tower of Babel? Oh my goodness, God is going to destroy us by sundown for this. This soon? And they're already building an altar to a foreign god? So Phinehas accuses them of breaking the covenant and bringing God's wrath, quote, upon the whole congregation of Israel.
Yeah, and he brings up Achan as an example.
He even mentions so that we don't have to make the connection and have people say you're reading too much into it.
Yeah.
He says, let me remind you of the covenantal principle involved here, representation.
Yep.
The whole nation will perish
if this
turns out to be true, that the eastern tribes, they're not saying God will destroy the eastern tribes or God will destroy the people who led this rebellion. Saying God will destroy all of us for what the eastern tribes are doing. And he's relieved to hear the explanation. The western tribes stand down from attacking and destroying the eastern tribes. Oh, okay. It's you're just building a memorial. Oh, okay. Okay.
I'm sorry. Emily Letella. Never mind.
Whoops. Never mind.
But wow. I mean, doesn't that on the one hand highlight the holy zeal of both sides? On one hand, it highlights the tension and the mutual suspicion provoked by the recognition of God's holiness and their own sinfulness. Everybody's on pins and needles. Mm-hmm. On one hand, you see the zeal. On the other hand, you see the fear.
Yeah, there's a history behind that. There's a golden calf incident behind that.
Achan.
There's Achan. There are some things in their past to remind Phinehas that, you know what, it's not unlike us to go back in that direction.
Well said.
Yeah, it's like
everyone, Yahweh, Joshua, now the western tribes, everyone is ready for the shoe to drop. Everyone's kind of anticipating a short honeymoon.
Right.
Once more, you see, too, the superiority of the new covenant, don't you, with no less than God himself, the Holy Spirit, being the altar of witness indwelling us.
Hmm.
The witness that we have is not simply a pile of stones somewhere. It is God himself indwelling us.
Well, that's to go back to the passage that Kim mentioned earlier from Ephesians 2. At the end of Ephesians 2, that's what Paul promises. You are being built together to be a holy temple, a dwelling place of God through the Spirit.
That's just amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so basically to summarize, we have seen God act triumphantly. He has crushed the serpent's head, at least the figurative serpent's head. Not yet at this point in history, the true serpent's head, but his minions. He's trampled serpents and scorpions. He has cleansed the land, and now he's given the land to his people. And now he says, all right, now keep it. It's yours to win or lose. And in our next program, we're going to see the seriousness with which the people of Israel took this responsibility, this oath. It's almost another Sinai moment. It is another Sinai moment where the people are pressed with this question. Are you going to keep all of the commandments now that God has given you the land? And we'll see what their answer is on the next episode of the White Horse Inn. Thanks for joining us. The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. To find out how to support our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also check out the support tab of our website at whitehorsein.org. That's whitehorsein.org.